Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
An impatient electorate on our imperfect union.
I think he's doing okay.
Not impressed at all.
You've got to give him time.
Think he did a good job?
Just scary.
Good solid B+.
The president looks ahead to his constitutionally mandated report card to the nation and gives himself a more than passing mark late last year. Grading on a curve, a B+, but does he work well with others? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. On this Tuesday, January 26th, where The Takeaway is, does the president work well with others? A lot of people in that House and Senate gallery are going to be thinking exactly that on the State of the Union address on Wednesday night.
Or finding reasons why they don't want to work with him. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. With his first State of the Union address tomorrow night, the president continues his full court economic press.
We're going to keep fighting to rebuild our economy so that hard work is once again rewarded, wages and incomes are once again rising, and the middle class is once again growing.
Yesterday, we told you about his package to help middle-class families. Today, we're learning President Obama will ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs. The Pentagon, veterans programs, foreign aid, and homeland security would all be exempt. The president's also expected to call for tighter rules on Wall Street and lift the ban on gays in the military.
State of the Union speech gives the president a chance to jumpstart his agenda, which has suffered political setbacks recently. Still, as President Obama tells ABC News, he's pushing forward.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
Better watch out. Don't want that to come through. Bill Rice joins us now, reporter for WCPN in Ohio, where the president was talking about jobs late last week. Wasn't referring to a one-term presidency, that's for sure. But Bill, the president ran on a campaign issue of change in America. Are voters in Ohio suddenly changing their views of the president?
Well, John, the president's poll numbers are turning against him in some quarters in Ohio, in some areas more than in others. Ohio's a state that's been hit very hard by the recession, and many people here are still not seeing the way out.
All right. Well, voters with pulses, we're going to probe the pulse of the voters in Ohio with Bill Rice, reporter for WCPN in Cleveland. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
As for the health care bill, congressional Democrats are rallying around their last best hope, which is passing the Senate bill with some changes to accommodate House Democrats. It's unclear, though, if they have the votes for it. In Haiti, the United Nations says up to 1 million people need shelter, and there's an urgent need for at least 200,000 tents. In a move to show solidarity with earthquake victims, Haiti's president plans to move into a tent on the lawn of his collapsed National Palace.
NATO forces say a blast hit near a U.S. military base in Afghanistan's capital. The head of Kabul's criminal investigations unit said it was a strike by suicide bombers at Camp Phoenix. Meanwhile, in Iraq, a suicide bomber killed at least 18 in a strike on a crime lab in Baghdad. Welfare rolls rose last year for the first time in 15 years. And get a load of this. One in five Americans said they didn't have the money to buy the food they needed at some point last year. The national survey found more than 38 million Americans, one out of every eight, now receive food stamps. That's a record high. Asian and European markets down. Futures are down. Wall Street's going to get underway. On the negative side, at 10,196 for the Dow, S&P 1,096, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,210. Coming up this hour, your work life every Tuesday. Can you swap jobs on your vacation? Beth Koblenner is going to have some suggestions later in the hour.
And why would you want to use your vacation for work? We're going to talk about good reasons for it. We're also looking ahead to President Obama's State of the Union address all this week. We'll have guests like General David Petraeus and Ford CEO Alan Mulally joining us. We want to get your take, though. What's your State of the Union, and can you describe it in six words or less?
This is Carol from Salt Lake City. My six words would be, how did we get here? Complacency.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to get a feel for how voters are feeling about Obama. Today, we go to Ohio. That's in just a few minutes.
Good morning, everyone. So fresh from the political wounds of that setback in Massachusetts last week, the president went off to Lorain, Ohio at the end of the week and talked about jobs and showcased some of the rhetoric we're likely to see in the State of the Union address later on this week. All about jobs in the middle of the recession. Northeast Ohio has an unemployment rate upwards of 10%. The entire state of Ohio's unemployment rate is 10.8%. Joining us to figure out where voters are and where they're likely to be between now and the off-year election in November of 2010 is Bill Rice, reporter and associate editor of news at WCPN in Ohio. You're there in the Idea Stream Mothership building there in downtown Cleveland, right, Bill?
Indeed.
All right. Good morning to you once again. And Jason Johnson is a professor of political science and a board member of the Garfield Institute for Public Leadership at Hiram College in Northeast Ohio. Good morning, Professor.
Glad to be here.
So, Bill, let me play you a couple of voices here of voters that you've been sort of exploring the psyches of, the pulses of on your programming ever since the president visited last week. And I want to sort of probe whether there's any demographic significance to these two very, very different positions on how Obama is doing. Listen.
I think he's doing okay. You know, we had a crisis on our hands, and I think he dealt with that as best as he could. I think, he had to make decisions, split-second decisions, and I think you can't fault him for some of the mistakes he may have made. Looking back, but considering the dilemma we're in, I think he did a good job.
I'm not impressed at all. I think that he's spending in places that I don't agree with the health care bill. That could be the destruction of our whole health care system, in my opinion. For businesses like ourselves, small businesses, it's just scary. Some of the things in there that are proposed are just very scary for our future and for a younger generation future especially.
Now, there's nothing scientific about those two voters, and their positions seem fairly well polarized. Bill, first of all, who do they represent, and where are the change makers in the Ohio electorate that are likely to be moving between now and November of 2010?
Well, for one thing, those people represent people who have jobs, and there are plentiful numbers of people here in Ohio that don't. One of those I recorded myself. He was at a business luncheon last week, and he's a white collar worker, and presumably his job is fairly safe. And his view reflects what you hear from a lot of people around here: is that the president did inherit a boondoggle of an economic situation. And you have to give him time to try to put in the policies to try to rectify that. This other gentleman, I presume he has a job just the way he speaks. I think he represents those independent voters that you hear about, people who may at one point have been in the Republican camp, were swayed by Obama's by the president's rhetoric during his campaign and convinced to vote for him, and now is feeling a little bit disillusioned, especially with the fight that we've seen over many, many months over health care in Washington.
All right, so two polarized people who apparently have jobs. Jason Johnson, let's talk about all of the people in Ohio who don't have jobs. Listen to the president's rhetoric last week in Lorain, Ohio, at the community college. It's in some sense predictable rhetoric, but I'm wondering if in the venue where he was speaking, it actually works. Listen.
I won't stop fighting for an economy where hard work is rewarded. I won't stop fighting to make sure there's accountability in our financial system. I'm not going to stop fighting until we have jobs for everybody.
Is there kind of a high risk, Jason Johnson, in that kind of rhetoric? Because Barack Obama's not going to get anybody a job between now and November, necessarily.
Right. And it sounds a lot like John Edwards, actually, when he was running during the campaign in 2008. He's going to fight, he's going to fight, he's going to fight. I don't think anyone doubts that Barack Obama actually cares about the job issue. I think the concern is people just want to see the jobs appear.
Right.
And I think in an area like Lorain, you know, you can talk about all that you want to do and all that you want to fight, but it's not also just bringing jobs. This is a part of the country that's been economically depressed for over 15 years. What kinds of jobs are you going to bring? Is it going to be construction? Is it going to be computers? Is it going to be the kind of thing that requires training? I think Obama needs to get more specific when he's in places like Northeast Ohio, because just saying jobs alone is not going to cut it.
So Jason Johnson, and you're a professor of political science at Hiram College in Northeast Ohio, does it play as flailing around then to not be specific?
it's not so much that it's flailing around. It's just people are waiting for the results. People are concerned about what kinds of employment is going to come through. There have been improvements. In Lordstown, Ohio, there are factories that have actually added new shifts. Some of the stimulus package money has worked in Columbus, Ohio, as far as repaving and working on roads. But the fact of the matter is, there was a large undercurrent of people in the state who really, really felt locked out of the economy over the last 8 years. They voted for Obama and Ted Strickland, the governor, because they thought that they were going to improve things, and they haven't seen anything yet. And by this November, they may be tired and looking for a change.
So Jason Johnson is describing that a clock is ticking. It's a political clock, and I think Susie's wearing that clock on her wrist. Listen.
I think he's doing the best that he can, considering what he walked into. You know, he walked into a mess, so you've got to give him time.
Bill Rice, that's another one of your voters. How much time do you think Obama has in Ohio?
Well, in Ohio, I think he's got a conservative tide running against him at this point. Again, those independent voters, many of whom do have jobs, some of who don't, but are very prominent in southern parts of the state, are going to make the case that this is not the change that they voted for. This is not the change that those people without jobs voted for, and maybe some of those people will either not show up when it comes time to vote or vote the other way.
Wow. Well, that's a bleak picture. Jason Johnson, before we go, does this talk of freezing spending, dealing with the deficit, reach the independents who are part of this conservative tide that Bill Rice is talking about?
The independents who have jobs love hearing that. The independents who are at home because they haven't found work, they don't care about a freeze in funding. They just want to find out when the jobs are going to be available. They want to find out if they're going to lose their unemployment benefits. They want to find out if spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week looking for a job is actually going to result in something effective. I think Obama's got quite a bit of time as far as his overall administration, but he may not have much time between January's State of the Union address and the November elections.
Well, Ohio voters looking for specifics on both sides of the aisle there in the upcoming State of the Union address. Jason Johnson, thanks so much. Professor of Political Science at Hiram College in Northeast Ohio. And Bill Rice, reporter and associate editor of news at WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks to both of you. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check out on the other stories we're following.
We're looking ahead to the president's State of the Union address tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern. He's expected to make a big push for jobs. Yesterday, he addressed the struggles of regular Americans.
Unfortunately, the middle class has been under assault for a long time. Too many Americans have known their own painful recessions long before any economist declared that there was a recession.
And last night on ABC, the president joked about what he would have told his former self about the year ahead.
You're going to look older in a year. You've got more gray.
During Wednesday's speech, he'll outline the agenda for the year ahead. In addition to job creation, it'll include tighter rules for Wall Street and lifting the ban on gays in the military.
The president also says he's serious about cutting the deficit. Tomorrow, he will call for a 3-year spending freeze on many domestic programs. We want your State of the Union address in 6 words or less. Think you can do it?
This is Brandon from Oklahoma City. I'm going to try the 6 words. How about, our system is broken, communism works?
Not bad. Give us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. In other news, more and more teenage girls are getting pregnant. The rate jumped 3% for the first time since 1990. The abortion rate also inched up 1%. And finally, the gender gap between college men and women has stopped growing. A new study says more men are now graduating from college, reversing a trend of females outnumbering male grads. The study author says the recession is sending more men back to school.
That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, with their forces combined, could they take over the concert ticket selling business? We're going to talk about a merger between Ticketmaster and Live Nation in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Get your news takeouts. Here in the studio is Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times, and Todd Zwillick down in Washington. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning, John.
So I'm confused, Todd Zwillick. In the middle of a recession, in the middle of talk in Washington about a second stimulus package, Obama is apparently going to roll out a positively Nixonian-sounding domestic spending freeze. What's going on?
Well, it smacks of fiscal responsibility, doesn't it? Freezing all increases in discretionary spending across the government. Now, this is on government programs except at the VA, which is health care and housing for veterans, DHS, which is Homeland Security, and of course, defense. Nobody wants to mess with that.
It sounds like an almost Reagan kind of a program, and we're going to hear about it specifically in the State of the Union address, right? Is he trying to appeal specifically to conservative Democrats and Republicans?
I think he's trying to appeal to all those people, but also independents who were, you know, I hate this phrase, I'm sorry, game changers, but who were the game changers in Massachusetts, and they're afraid.
Were they the game changers in Massachusetts, Todd?
They were the game changers in Massachusetts, but maybe across the country. But on this domestic spending freeze, it's really unclear how this is going to work. Don't forget, spending is only one side of the equation in deficits. Revenue is the other side. And unless tax revenue goes up and business improves, cutting spending doesn't really improve the bottom line as much. It's a two-sided coin. Also, this is just a presidential proposal, John. It's up to Congress to decide how much to spend. And their power under Article 1 of the Constitution is in spending money. They don't like to have it curtailed. And the other thing I should point out, that discretionary spending, freezing it, is great. It's going to be politically popular and does help with the deficit. It's not where the real money is. The real money is in the entitlements. Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, and defense, none of those is included in this proposal. That's where the big money is in the long term.
All right, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Maybe we'll see some specific numbers tomorrow night. Thanks.
Definitely not a spending freeze in the world of music. Yesterday, the U.S. Justice Department cleared the way for a huge merger between two of the world's biggest concert promoters. And Louis Story, our partner from the New York Times, is here to explain it to us. Who's merging?
So we've got Live Nation. You know, they're a giant concert promoter. And Ticketmaster, which is the biggest ticket selling and artist management company. And what's interesting is, you know, Ticketmaster has been around from the 70s. They've been reviled off and on by artists. You probably remember Pearl Jam in the 1990s,
right.
You know, taking a case to the DOJ because they wanted to sell tickets under $20. But of course, Ticketmaster didn't want that. And Live Nation has been more of an upstart. So now you've got the upstart joining the Goliath. It's a merger that Bruce Springsteen has warned is a near monopoly. But the problem is, it's a vertical integration. That's in business where you take the whole pipeline process and merge it rather than direct competitors. And it's much more difficult for the DOJ to fight cases against vertical integration.
Meaning that they're not duplicating services.
That's right.
Right. They're just more
They're
on
handling
the chain.
Different parts of the music production, music concert situation. So what the Department of Justice has done is imposed some rules on them about this merger. They've said, for instance, that this merged company cannot punish venues if they, for instance, don't use them for concert promotion but want to use one of their artists. They can't do that. They can't share data between divisions. So they've just put some restrictions on.
You know, Celeste, what do you think? You think Louise is a Pearl Jam fan?
Oh, yeah.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think? Louise?
You know, I think I prefer Madonna, who is a Live Nation artist. I kind of have a soft spot there for those 80s hits.
Well, and she's quite the businesswoman also.
She is quite the
businesswoman. That's right. Correct. Correct.
Louise Story, thanks so much. Business and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
So in yesterday's show, we talked with two doctors about the provocative question of whether the experience of childhood sexual abuse is traumatic to the victim and exactly when. It got this listener thinking about an event in her own life.
This is Colette. When I was younger, I visited my family doctor and he touched me inappropriately. The interesting thing was I didn't realize it until years later that what he did was wrong, but I'm not traumatized by the event. I knew then something wasn't quite right, but, you know, it happened, and I'm like, you know, that wasn't right, but it hasn't affected me. So, you know, I just think this discussion of whether, you know, something is trauma at the time or trauma upon recognition of the event not being appropriate is interesting and relevant.
Well, Colette didn't tell us if she had ever reported the incident with the doctor, aside from mentioning it to us, but one of our guests, Dr. Susan Clancy, an author of The Trauma Myth, said yesterday on the program that use of the word trauma can be a disincentive for people to report their abuse.
I completely understand the importance of calling this event a trauma from sort of the adult perspective. But the problem is that because of our positioning the event as trauma, but not clarifying details of the event, you end up with a lot of people out there who never report the sexual abuse to anyone and who themselves don't necessarily feel like they were victims because their understanding of the event was when it happened, it was not traumatic.
And we got a number of responses on that issue.
I think the reason why it's not good to put it in terms of a trauma is a lot of times people who have been abused are afraid that they're going to be stigmatized by what happened to them, even if the event itself wasn't traumatic. The borderline shame makes it more traumatic by the way that they feel they're going to be abused by people around them.
Wow. Hi, this is Megan calling from Detroit, Michigan, and I have to say I'm horrified by assertions that some child sexual abuse victims are not traumatized by what happened to them. I agree that child sexual abuse creates a wide range of different reactions in many different people, but to say that it is not inherently traumatic when someone close to you breaks your trust and abuses you is disturbing, to say the least.
Well, we suspected we'd get lots of responses to our discussion of child abuse. You can listen to it again on demand at our website, thetakeaway.org.
And thanks to all of you for sharing your stories with us. We want to hear with you about anything that touches a nerve. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. All this week, we're also looking ahead to the State of the Union address on Wednesday, and we're asking you, what is your State of the Union?
This is Karen from Rockville Center, New York. My State of the Union is, I hope we still can.
And on our website, 19 Forever writes, sick nation, no medicine in sight. Nora writes, I bring more of the same. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the images coming out of Haiti. Are they too graphic, or do they serve a news purpose? More on that in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A day ahead of his first State of the Union address, President Obama tells ABC News he's not concerned about the dip in his job approval rating.
When your poll numbers drop, you're an idiot. When your poll numbers are high, you're a genius. If my poll numbers are low, then I'm cool and cerebral and cold and detached.
In tomorrow night's speech, the president is expected to ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs, as well as call for tighter rules on Wall Street and lift the ban on gays in the military. Early this morning, we asked presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, how will we know if the president's speech is successful?
Usually, State of the Unions are judged not so much by the performance, even though that's what we'll do the day after, or the popularity of the words, but by whether the president is able to mobilize Congress, the interest groups, and the people to fight for his goals.
And we're asking you to give us your impressions. Can you describe the State of the Union in six words or less?
This is Mark calling from Massachusetts. No one in Washington wants to do anything. So unfortunately, the six words that talk about the state of the nation is, who can we blame for this?
Share yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to the website, thetakeaway.org.
We're getting a lot of these. In Haiti now, desperation boiled over at the wrecked National Palace yesterday. UN peacekeepers had to fire pepper spray into the air to disperse a crowd of thousands jostling for food. Lieutenant General Ken Keene of the U.S. military says there haven't been any problems with the Haitian people.
There have been no security incidents that have impacted our ability to deliver aid, and there has been no incidents against any of the U.S. forces in our as we go out and do our job.
In Oregon today, a special election is going to decide whether to raise taxes on the wealthy and on business. A panel mandated by Congress says the U.S. is not ready for a biological terrorism attack. And let's look at the markets. Asian and European markets down. Futures are now mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,196. The S&P opens at 1,096. The NASDAQ at 2,210. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
For 2 weeks, we've been bombarded with photos and video of the devastation in Haiti. I was looking through a photo essay on the web with pictures of corpses in the streets and horribly injured survivors, and I had to ask myself, are some of these images too graphic? Do they exploit the people and the culture that they represent? We're joined now by Paul Taggart. He faces these questions every day in his job as a photojournalist. He's been covering Haiti since the earthquake hit, and he's currently in the Dominican Republic, but is returning to Haiti soon. And Kenneth Irby joins us as well, leader of the Visual Journalism Group at the Poynter Institute. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Paul, we've featured some of your photos from Haiti on our website. Can you tell me about some of the more striking pictures that you've taken?
One of the stories we worked on in that first week of coverage was following a man named Montpezier Nazil, who's a 56-year-old man who volunteered on the first day after the quake to collect bodies in the street. which is both, you know, medically important to get these off the street, is also just for the mentality of the people. So I ended up following him for 3 or 4 days over the last week and a half. And so some of those images are rather graphic, but I think in the context of following this volunteer Haitian, it's more of a rounded out story, but pretty dramatic stuff.
So you face this particular issue every day as you bring a shot into your lens, and you have to consider whether to take a photo or not. You're getting paid for your work. Do you ever feel like you're exploiting the subjects of your photos?
No, I don't. I wouldn't take a picture if I thought that I was. Just like any job or anybody doing anything, I think we have an inherent sort of understanding of morality, and I'm not going to do something just because I have a camera that I wouldn't do otherwise. And as far as like deciding to take a picture or not take a picture, I usually lean on the side of taking the picture. Whether I file it or not is a different story, and whether an editor uses it in the context in which they use it is something to keep an eye on and keep track of. So I think that's more important of how the image is used, where it's used in the context of it, than whether you actually take the photograph or not.
Okay, I want you both to listen to this phone call from one of our listeners.
The name is Tim, calling from Denver, Colorado. It's degenerated a little bit into the balloon boy deal. A lot of the media is like that nowadays. It's not about news. It's about what sells and what can be used to excite people, and most of all, what can be used to scare people.
Kenny, you're not just you don't just work at the Poynter Institute, but you yourself were a photographer. Do you think that the images out of Haiti are used to excite people or scare them?
No, absolutely not, Celeste. I think that the images that I've seen have been a valiant and purposeful attempt to help inform society, particularly we're talking about American coverage, about a very traumatic and sad reality that's happened to our neighbors, not far from us. And the photographs, as we were just hearing from Paul, have brought a vicarious perspective that people need to be able to visualize in order to understand the magnitude of the tragedy there.
But in your duties, what do you think is going too far? What kind of guidelines do you give to photographers to say, take this photo but not this one?
Oh, well, the guidelines, the first thing you have to understand is that the photojournalists are human beings first. They're not robots, and, you know, their guiding principle as journalists working for media organizations and independently those like Paul as well, I mean, their guiding principles are to maximize truth-telling. We teach. There are guidelines in place to seek and report the fullest truth possible, and also to be compassionate and thoughtful in terms of minimizing harm. So there are guidelines in place for journalists to govern them. The bigger problem, I think, is not the principles of the journalists, it's the ignorance of the American people. The American people have been protected, sheltered, and privileged, and don't want to see the kinds of realities that are happening outside of our borders, and to take a responsibility that we have as Americans to help those that are in need.
Although, Kenneth and Paul, you can weigh in as well. When my kids look at a picture like that, they don't think about Haiti. They think about just the person who died, the one person who died. In an earthquake that's the biggest in 200 years, do people of Haiti and corpses in Haiti lose their private rights and become public figures, in a sense, in the pursuit of a historic news story, Kenneth?
Absolutely. I think we've seen that not just only in Haiti. We've seen that in America in 9/11 and the Oklahoma City bombing. There have been situations, even on our own soil, where the news magnitude supersedes individual privacy. Now, that happens because of the news and the news value and the historic value. But journalists are taught to always seek to preserve the dignity of the bereaved, of the deceased, and the survivors that are there. And I think these photographs, as you alluded to in the lead-in, there are some things that journalists see for the purpose of helping the democracy and the society understand the proportions that they don't share. And so there's a thoughtful process of what should be what's shared and where that line is. And that line is a fine line. And it is relative to the society. Now, today we see we see far more horrific stuff, and children see far more horrific stuff in the video games and movies. And this is truthful reality that we need to be having the conversations with our children about. And that's one of the things that a lot of parents don't want to do.
Kenneth Irby is the leader of the Visual Journalism Group at the Poynter Institute. Paul Taggart is a photojournalist covering Haiti. He's heading back there this week. What do you think? Have the photos from Haiti been exploitive? Did it force you to turn away? What's the balance between the need to know and the desire for dignity? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can leave a comment below this segment on our website, thetakeaway.org. We also have a slideshow there from Paul Taggart at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about work life as we do every Tuesday. If you're looking for a career change, you might think about taking a vacation at work. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And joining us now is the swashbuckling, dashing old friend of mine, Hugh Schofield, BBC correspondent in Paris. Good morning, Hugh.
Well, thank you very much, John.
It's great to hear your voice once again.
Yeah, and likewise.
Let's talk about this serious story in France. A parliamentary commission this morning has recommended that Muslim women should not be allowed to wear face-covering veils in public service facilities such as hospitals, schools, and public transport. The French have already banned such garments in state schools. Where is this likely to go, and how controversial is it?
It's likely to come into law. I mean, as you say, this is a first step. It's a parliamentary committee, so nothing's going to happen straight away. And there's going to be a long gap now because we've got elections coming up, and they don't want to push this through before those regional elections in March. But, you know, there is political impetus behind this, and it seems to me more than likely that this law, which falls short of a full ban on the full veil, will come into effect probably, I don't know, later on this year. But it is controversial. Controversial in the sense that many people think that this is not enough. I mean, there's probably a majority of people who are saying in France they do want a complete ban on the full veil, the sort of wraparound eye face covering veil. But you know, there are also people who, of course, take completely the opposite view and say this is the government legislating on something which it has no business legislating on, and that it's cracking a nut with a very large sledgehammer, which is going to cause all sorts of problems for community relations.
Well, Hugh, listen to the voice of this French Muslim woman, Nora Rami.
I think that personally, as far as I'm concerned as a Muslim, I don't think it's religious obligation, so I have a few problems with it. But at the same time, I don't think that banning the wearing of niqab will be the solution to the problem.
What is the, remind us of the problem that she's referring to, and why a majority think it's disruptive for Muslim women to wear observant clothing in public?
Well, you've got to remember two things. One, France is a country with a very, very strong, one could almost say radical secular tradition, which feels absolutely no compunction because of its sort of its sense of self of the revolutionary past. Has no compunction at all about insisting on a secular public lifestyle. It feels it had a long battle of the Christian church back, which only ended, 100 years ago or less. And there's a common feeling that a new front line has opened up in which the secular state has to assert itself. On the other hand, there is evidence, anecdotal evidence, but I mean, from my eyes, in my neighborhood, I see it happening the all encompassing veil is appearing. I mean, it's very, very rare and marginal still, but 5 years ago, you never saw it in France. Now you do see it, and that offends certain people, not just women, but also many people who are very attached to France and its republic.
Indeed.
So we've had a bit of a, it's all come together, and now there's this great pressure to do something.
Well, change is afoot, and we're talking about it this morning, the possibility that French women will not be allowed to wear face covering veils in public service facilities such as hospitals, schools, and public transport. Talking with Hugh Schofield. Hugh, if I come to Paris, can I crash at your place?
Yeah, no problem.
You know, I got five kids now.
Well, I've still got your book on my shelf.
All right. Hugh Schofield.
Yeah, remember that?
BBC correspondent. Yes, indeed. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talk about work on Tuesdays. And what do you think? Taking a vacation at work? Does that sound like a good idea? Maybe not to you.
I'm on vacation right now.
Maybe not to you, but there's other people who will actually pay money to take vacation at someone else's job. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. As the president gets ready for his first State of the Union address tomorrow, he tells ABC News he's focused on being effective, not securing a second term.
There's a tendency in Washington to think that our job description of elected officials is to get reelected.
But he says politicians should aspire to more.
That's not our job description. Our job description is to solve problems and to help people.
Also during the speech, he'll introduce a 3-year spending freeze to help reduce the $1 trillion budget deficit. The freeze will not apply to key departments, including defense and security. Earlier this morning, we asked presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, how will we know if the president's speech is successful?
Every president has to make the general people feel, I'm on your side. It doesn't mean he has to scream and yell, but it means that he has to make people remember the person who won that election in 2008, where people felt, he'll be fighting for me. I think there has to be a fighting tone.
And we want to get your take on this. What's the state of our union? And do you think you can describe it in just 6 words?
This is Bill from Staten Island, New York. And my 6-word phrase is, this guy lies through his teeth.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it on our site, thetakeaway.org.
That sounds more like the response speech rather than the State of the Union. Moving to other news, consumer confidence is an important indicator of economic health, and it's due out this morning. Business and finance reporter for the New York Times, Louise Story, joins us. Louise, how important is consumer confidence, and what's the trend at this point that the economists are expecting?
Consumer confidence is one of the most important indicators. You know, consumer spending makes up, you know, often 2/3 of the economy. And so this morning's figure will be very closely watched. Consumer confidence went up a little in December, and economists think it will go up a little more this month. Economists also think that the number of people who think it's hard to get a job will go down a bit. But, you know, we won't really know till 10. If you remember a couple weeks ago, economists were a little too rosy on those job figures and their expectations. The job figures were worse than they expected, so we'll see if the economists are right.
Louise, is consumer confidence a lagging, leading, or coincident indicator in your view?
You know, actually, it's often ahead, because when consumers start feeling better, then they start spending. And when they start spending, the economy picks up. And when the economy picks up, people hire more people. So it's often ahead. But this, you know, this recession is one we're watching closely to see if we have a double dip or any kind of backtracking. And so, you know, all bets are off.
All right. A leading indicator from our leader, Louise Story, business and finance reporter for The New York Times. In other news, Washington, the Transportation Department is announcing this morning an immediate ban on text messaging by truck and bus drivers on the road. The ban applies to drivers of interstate buses and trucks over 10,000 pounds. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
It is time to talk about work here on The Takeaway. Today's topic, vocation vacation. So that means a vacation where you work, but at somebody else's job. Many of you are thinking, why on earth would I want to work when I finally get some vacation days? Beth Kobliner, our work contributor, has some reasons, and I hope they're good ones, Beth, on why we would want to do that.
Promise.
We're also joined by Mike Leonard. He's a former vocation vacationer. He joins us from Washington, D.C., about how it led him down a new career path. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Beth, what is a vocation vacation?
It's basically a temporary position in an out-of-town location that you can offer, that can offer you work experience. So, and sometimes you actually pay to work. And other times you can be paid to work. But if you're looking for a job right now and you're hoping to switch, this is something to consider, you know, in the context of the fact that right now unemployment is at 10%. Huge number of people who have jobs who are not happy with their jobs. The Conference Board just released a study showing that unhappiness at jobs are at the highest level in 22 years. People are staying unemployed for, on average, 8 months. That's 10 weeks longer than it was a year ago. So given all that, a vocation vacation is sort of like we've talked before about internships or seasonal jobs. It basically offers you a chance
to get some foot in the door for a job or for work for a week or two.
Here's the thing,
yeah.
though.
I knew you guys were going to be
skeptical. I can't sit in for a brain surgeon, though, right?
Yeah. But here's the thing, Beth. If you're unemployed, you know, the number one vocation vacation probably doesn't help. I don't think that, you know, the vocation thing will help that. I mean, there's just a huge unemployment rate in the United States. The other thing is that how are you going to have the money
right
to pay to go work somebody else's job?
Well, I knew you were going to say that. And, you know, honestly, when I first heard this topic, I thought that, you know, and everybody thinks of those as those frivolous vacations that either, you know, wealthy parents send their teenagers who are bored, you know,
right.
to work and, you know, build
or
huts
some
in
bored
countries.
Retired person. Or,
exactly. But actually, these are now growing in interest because, first of all, you can do it for less money. You can do it for under $300. They're good places like, you know, if you're at a situation where you don't have a job, you can't get a job, and you've always wanted to try something else. And we have Mike here who's going to be talking a little bit about his situation. But there's, you know, coloradotrail.org or wildernessvolunteers.org. And we'll put all these on the website. There are places you can go for less than $300. There are lots of different websites offering a lot of opportunities that give you 2 weeks of working in a totally different field that may not lead to a permanent job, absolutely, but it could open your mind and make you think about creative possibilities. You know, there was one woman I spoke with who worked in a bake shop, and then eventually it led her to opening her own bake shop.
Okay, so Mike Leonard, you're now a program analyst with the Department of Energy. What vacation did you take?
Well, let's see. I was a freshman in college walking around Boston and stumbled upon a brochure in an outdoor store for an organization called Wilderness Volunteers that runs backcountry service trips throughout the country. So that entails everything from trail building, trail maintenance, campsite restoration, fence removal in the national parks, national forests, wilderness areas. And we work with federal agencies that need the help.
Isn't this just you paying them for volunteer work?
Some people see it that way. It is, in a sense, you donating your free time to do some work. But on the
sounds
flip
like
side,
fun. Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Well, my friends all think I'm crazy.
The interesting thing about Mike's story was he was talking about how he was, you know, an economics major on the track to being, you know, banking. Now this is about how many 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when everybody was going into these fields, or a lot of people were going into these fields, and what it did was broaden an interest for him and got him very interested in environmental interest areas, which has led to his career at the energy department. So what I'm saying is it opens people's horizons. And in this particular economy, I think we have to think creatively. And I think a lot of people, it's very upsetting. And I'm saying that for the $200 vacation, that might be something that opens, you know, gives you a little kick, you know, outlook and information and a new experience that can lead you to looking in a different area.
Does this qualify if you're on unemployment and you get some cash through their training program? Does this qualify as a job training program?
Well, it doesn't qualify. I mean, it's like not under the stimulus package. It's not like one of those clear job training programs. No, but it is something that it could potentially. There could be parts of it. You have to check with your tax person. Parts of it could potentially be tax deductible, so you have to look into that. But I think it's more of an experience. They're seasonal jobs. If you go to, you know, a skiing area and you love to ski and you need to earn a chunk of money, this might be the time to do it. Again, it's sort of like we've talked a lot about seasonal jobs, internships. It beats the alternative for a lot of people of not doing anything. And the point is, and we're going to have it on the website, there are a lot of organizations that offer these for a lot less money than I think people would think. And it offers you something to do in this very tough environment.
That's our takeaway contributor, Beth Koblenzer. And Mike Leonard joins us, a program analyst at the Department of Energy and a former vacationer. Thanks to both of you.
You know, Beth Koblenzer is always urging us to be creative, isn't she?
She is.
Yeah, that's right. We never have to do that for our listeners. But if you have a job sharing, a job swap idea that you'd be interested in, give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also weigh in on the State of the Union in 6 words. Or less. Creativity? Well, you decide.
Hi, it's Carla Gramatica from Pelham, New York. Rome wasn't built in a day.
My 6 words for the State of the Union is painfully coming back from the abyss.
creativity. Thy name is Takeaway Listener. Yes, indeed. We're hearing from you about the State of the Union this week. We're talking with General David Petraeus, guests like historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. We want to get your take, too. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to the website, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, we talked earlier about the photos, some of them disturbing, coming out of Haiti. We have a slideshow from our guest, photojournalist Paul Taggart. That's at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. I just want to give you one last little piece of news. The census began today. First guy in an Arctic village, Clifton Jackson. The first in 309 million to go. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway. Two weeks after the earthquake in Haiti, medical attention has shifted from emergency trauma care to rebuilding the medical infrastructure.
Today we saw nearly 300 patients, and very few of them actually had earthquake-related events. So what we're seeing now is that the patient population has shifted to the normal daily activities.
But normal activities at a hospital require beds and buildings, good record-keeping, post-op wards, and lots of nurses. And there's the next challenge. How do you treat Haitians that don't need the ER? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 26th, and The Takeaway is, how do you rebuild something that may not have existed in the first place in Haiti?
And they're going to need a lot of long-term care as a result of this earthquake. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. We begin in Washington. President Obama speaking on the political minefield ahead of him.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
Well, he will make his case in his first State of the Union address, the president telling ABC News.
We've been so focused on just getting things done that I think that we stopped giving voice to the frustrations that people have about the process here in Washington.
To remedy that, he offered a package to help middle-class families yesterday. Today, we're learning the president will ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs, as well as call for tighter rules on Wall Street and lift the ban on gays in the military.
As the aid continues to pour into Haiti, one resource desperately needed is nurses. Joining us now is Jeanette Sangos, a nurse practitioner. Good morning. You went to Haiti to offer your services as a nurse. Were there enough nurses when you were there?
No, there were not enough nurses. In fact, when we got there, they could not even continue doing surgery at night because there were not enough nurses to take care of the patients. And also, the night before, the patients who were in the post-op, spend the whole night without anybody caring for them. There were no nurses at all.
We're going to be talking about that shortage and the implications of it in just a minute with Jeanette Sangos. Stay with us for them.
A parliamentary commission in France has recommended that Muslim women should not be allowed to wear face-covering veils when using public services, including hospitals, schools, and public transportation. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris, who told us the measure is controversial, but perhaps not in the way you think.
It is controversial. Controversial in the sense that many people think that this is not enough. There's probably a majority of people who are saying in France they do want a complete ban on the full veil, the sort of wraparound eye face covering veil.
There are an estimated 5 million Muslims in very secular France.
Here at home, welfare rolls rose last year for the first time in 15 years, but the 5% increase was dwarfed by spikes in the number of people receiving food stamps and unemployment insurance. Nearly one in five Americans said they didn't have the money to buy the food they needed at some point last year. The national survey also found more than 38 million Americans, that's one out of every eight, now receive food stamps. That's a record high. And a big upset this morning at the Australian Open. Defending champ Rafael Nadal is out in the quarterfinals after retiring because of a knee injury. We'll talk about that more later today. Futures are mixed in the markets. The Dow will get underway at 10,196. The S&P opens at 1,096 and the NASDAQ at 2210. Coming up this hour, we'll talk with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin to talk about how President Obama is doing so far. That's later this hour.
She writes very long books, Doris Kearns Goodwin does, but can you give us a State of the Union in few words, say 6 words?
Ryan from Boston, 6 words on the State of the Union. Everybody knows somebody out of work.
Be creative, won't you? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. I love Doris Kearns Goodwin's long books. Long is good.
Yeah, long books actually, are they really are. You can dig into them with a cup of tea.
Coming up, more about Haiti and the medical needs in that earthquake-ravaged country.
Since the earthquake devastated much of the Haitian capital 2 weeks ago, the outpouring of support has been massive, and that includes support from the medical community. Doctors from around the world have flown into Haiti, and now there may actually be too many doctors there and not enough nurses or supplies.
There's an incredible amount of work that needs to be done, not just the medical care, but essentially building a hospital. So ranging from providing shelter and tents to getting food in, working on sanitation, communications, coordinating surgeries, getting supplies. We're building a medical institution for these people.
That was Dr. Paul Auerbach. He's a professor of surgery in the Division of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University. He spoke with our producer from Port-au-Prince yesterday. He's talking about the inherent problems involved in completely rebuilding a medical infrastructure. And we're joined again by Jeanette Sangal. She's an Haitian-American nurse practitioner who returned from Haiti on Friday. Also with us is Marianne McCune, reporter with WNYC Radio, who's been talking to medical professionals about the situation in Haiti. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jeanette, when you were there, what kind of hours were you working? How many patients did you tend to each day?
I really was working about between 16 and 18 hours, really, and sleeping about 2-3 hours, really. And the amount of patients that we were taking care of, I will say on our ward, really, we had about 70 patients, who I will say about 70 patients, it may be more, and we were really taking care of everything from OBGYN to post-op to any emergency that comes in. It was really everything.
You know, Marianne, she's talking about a shortage. She was talking about a shortage of nurses earlier, but there's a number of problems in terms of rebuilding and in some times completely building the medical infrastructure in Haiti. Here's one of the doctors you interviewed at the Kingsbrook Jewish Medical Center in Brooklyn.
We now have pallets about 8 foot high of gauze pads and 8 foot high of masks and 8 foot high of gloves. We have a small warehouse full of all kinds of blood pressure medications. We have sterile surgical trays, sanitizers to clean those trays. We have antiseptics for the patients. We have antibiotics for the patients. And we can't get down there.
Is that a common complaint, that there are supplies available that they can't get them into Haiti?
Supplies and people. That was Dr. William Lois, and he was among a group of doctors who were trying desperately to get down to Haiti, trying to get on a military flight or some flight, and they ended up giving up and going through the Dominican Republic. But so single-minded about getting there that they're, on their BlackBerries nonstop. And one of the reasons they felt it was so important that they get there is they speak Creole. They have experience. They're part of two overlapping groups that both have experience, years of experience working in Haiti. So they have the language there. They felt that they could do a great job. They know the General Hospital, which is where they ended up going to work. And
were they sending nurses? Or just
they
doctors?
Were sending a group of all kinds of doctors.
Everything.
And that really, one of them just returned, and I spoke to him recently, and he said that that was one of the really important things. And Jeanette Sangos was with a previous group who went down.
Jeanette, what was the medical infrastructure like in Haiti before? People say where they're starting from scratch. Are they rebuilding an infrastructure that was there, or are they actually just creating something out of nothing?
I will say maybe there was a little something there, but not good enough to really receive this massive amount of traumatized patients. And that's what it was before. To start with, we didn't have almost really not much, nothing, I will say that. And it's like in the middle of a chaos, trying to construct really something so we can give as much care as possible to these patients.
Go ahead, Mary.
One of the things that Dr. Michel Charles, the doctor who just came back with that same group that Jeanette was with, he said you know, it's not necessarily the challenge of treating the patient or doing the right surgery. It's they got to the general hospital. They had to go with an engineer to figure out which buildings were okay to work in.
Wow.
And they made all these different units in those buildings, an ER, a pre-op, and a post-op. And he talked about one of the biggest challenges for him logistically and emotionally was that the first day they set up all these they moved all these patients inside, and then that night there was an earthquake. The big aftershock, and he arrived the next morning, and we have some tape of what happened.
So when we get there, we found everybody outside because they have to move them because they didn't want to stay. You want to bring them up, they don't want to go back. That was really, really bad. We didn't know what to do. I didn't know. I didn't have a plan B. I didn't have that plan B. We didn't expect that. So you have to really see what I'm going to do.
Jeanette, we also heard reports coming out of Haiti that there's so many different independent teams working that sometimes somebody's dressings will be removed 5 times an hour because different teams of doctors will come through checking on the same patients. It sounds like there's a real lack of organization there.
Yes, I will say that. I definitely agree with that. In fact, myself, I must say on my last day in Haiti, I was able to really make some progress when it comes to that. In fact, my best day working, really, because I was able to establish chart for the patient, establish what medication they are supposed to be they are on, and so this way, and give report really to the other team coming in, so they knew exactly what to do. That part we established that progress, and also I know the physician coming now that went on Saturday, who took after us, really, Dr. August had said to stayed in Haiti to give them a report of what was going on, all the challenges that we had to deal with. So I really hope at that point now that things are in place. But we had that problem. There was not that coordination, really.
Okay, that's Jeanette Sangal. She's a nurse practitioner. She just returned from a trip to Haiti on Friday, and Marianne McCune is a reporter with WNYC Radio. And the big question here also is what happens in a few weeks when all these volunteers go home. You can read a dispatch from an intern who's gone to Haiti to volunteer at a hospital there at thetakeaway.org.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Let's check in and now on the headlines at 15 minutes past the hour.
During tomorrow's State of the Union address, the president is expected now to ask Congress for a spending freeze on some domestic programs starting next year. The Pentagon, veterans programs, and Homeland Security would be exempt. Even as the White House is under pressure to cut the national debt, the president told ABC News he won't be raising taxes on the middle class.
I can guarantee that the worst thing we could do would be to raise taxes when the economy is still this weak.
We want to get your take, too. What's the state of our union? Are you in that middle class? Think you can do it in just 6 words? Here's Mark in Brooklyn's suggestion.
My 6 words are, I just started. Give me time.
Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
In other news, it looks like Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke will be confirmed for another term. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the confirmation should be smooth.
There's still a great amount of anxiety in our economy, but Chairman Bernanke helped the president and the economic team steer through some very turbulent times and rough waters.
Bernanke's current term ends on Sunday. Home prices rose nationally for the 6th straight month in November, with 14 of the 20 metro areas tracked showing improvements. Phoenix and San Francisco posted the highest month-to-month gains. New York and Chicago had the largest declines. Finally, young girls may learn to fear math from their teachers. A new study says young students model themselves after adults of the same sex, and female teachers who are anxious about their own math skills may be passing that fear on to their female students. That's a look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up, a blast in Baghdad has killed at least 18. We'll get the latest from the New York Times' John Leland.
Good morning, everyone. Grim headline out of Baghdad this morning from where John Leland, New York Times reporter, joins us. A car bomb killed at least 18 and injured dozens more in a strike against the Interior Ministry's offices in central Baghdad. Apparently, some hotels were also hit by apparently coordinated suicide attacks. John Leland, this main facility that was destroyed by the car bomb, what was it?
It was their forensics office, their forensics department. It was not the main office of the Ministry of the Interior, which I think would have been a totally devastating attack. And it was one of the more exposed public buildings here in Baghdad. It was right close to a main traffic rotary. So the bomb blew up just on the rotary.
So, and you can hear that John Leland is on a sketchy Skype connection there from Baghdad at the New York Times Bureau in Baghdad. So it's more a target of opportunity than a specific, target that might suggest why these attacks took place. So what are the claims of responsibility at this point?
Well, the military here believes it's al-Qaeda. The government has said it is al-Qaeda acting in conjunction with former members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. And most people seem to believe that we're seeing escalating violence in advance of the elections. Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister here, has really made his reputation, staked his reputation on being able to create a secure environment. And any attacks are believed to be an attempt to undermine that claim.
And finally, we were receiving reports yesterday of the execution of Ali Kamawi, so-called Chemical Ali, Saddam Hussein's most famous relative. Any chance this is related to that?
Certainly yesterday's bombings of three major hotels were not connected with that, because they were really sophisticated operations that would have taken weeks and possibly months of planning. Today's attack is likely not connected with it, but it is more possibly connected with it.
Finally, any change on the part of U.S. forces in Iraq as in terms of countermeasures protecting Baghdad?
The U.S. forces have largely moved out of the cities. They're not doing operations in the cities anymore unless asked by the Iraqi security forces. So their focus is mainly on electronic intelligence in different ways, and the Iraqis are doing the human intelligence. And on both sides, they're saying there's a better sharing of information now.
But certainly some level of insecurity there in Baghdad. John Leland is a New York Times reporter in Baghdad. Thanks so much.
Let's go to Australia now. In tennis, Rafael Nadal bowed out of the Australian Open after he suffered a knee injury during his quarterfinal game. We're joined now by John Wertheim, who stayed up. He's a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. He's in Melbourne covering the Open. John, what happened to Nadal today? Is this part of his tendonitis problem?
Well, we hope it's only that serious. It was really a sensational match with Andy Murray. It was really very high-quality tennis. Nadal's a defending champion. Murray's a top-five player. And then toward the end of the second set, the beginning of the third set, Nadal clearly did something to his knee. We're sort of still awaiting word. But, here's a guy who really competes harder than anyone else. And for him to retire, for him to basically just sort of quit in the middle of the match and say, I'm not fit to continue, it must be pretty serious. And it was really... really an unfortunate way to end what had been, for two sets anyway, just a great tennis match.
He has been had trouble with his knees, as we talked about earlier, with tendonitis, and some people say that's because of his playing style. Do you agree?
I do, and I'm not sure there's an alternative style. I mean, it's just sort of the way his game is built and his body is built. But, no, it really has become quite a concern that he was, a year ago he won this tournament and really seemed to be, he was the number one ranked player and really seemed to be one of these guys that could challenge for the all-time great. And he's had these injuries since, and you wonder, given how physical his tennis is and they play on these hard courts and the game, the rackets have gotten lighter and the hitting's gotten harder, you really worry if he can sustain a decent career now.
Do you think this may be the end of his career? I mean, you're talking about whether or not he can sustain it. Can we expect to see him back?
I think we'll see him back. I mean, he's still in his early 20s, and maybe there are adjustments he can make both to his game and to his playing schedule. But, I think we see this in other sports, too, where there's some of these athletes who just, they have a certain way they play. It's so physically taxing, and I think he'll be back, but I don't think now his trajectory is to go on to be one of the greatest ever. I just don't think. I think the game's gotten too physical, and I think his body might just not be cut out for it.
But let's take apart the physical bit for a second. I mean, Nadal's physical is lower extremities, whereas someone like one of the other players, it's more the forehand, the actual strokes that where the strength comes.
Yeah, exactly. He also has sort of a big upper body, which I think taxes the lower body. But I think some of it, too, is just the style he plays, which is this grinding physical style. He runs after every ball. He's not light on his feet, as they say. And it's really a joy to watch. It's a great contrast to some of the other players. But, I've likened it sort of to Earl Campbell, the old running back. Some
right.
guys sort of are fleet of foot and dance around the side, and others just sort of run up the gut. And I think, unfortunately for Nadal, it's just such a heavy game he plays, and his mentality is to go after every ball. It just doesn't lend itself to a long career, unfortunately.
So, John Wertheim, who's left in the Australian Open to watch for?
Well, there's still, Justine Henin on the women's side is a big story, and, we have Roger Federer, who's going for still another Grand Slam. I mean, there are plenty of storylines to follow, but again, it was such a nice match tonight. It was awfully disappointing to see it end the way it did.
Okay, John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He joined us from Melbourne,
and
Australia.
That's a great comparison to Earl Campbell, because in the end, even though he was a legend, his body gave out on him. It does on so many NFL players. So, coming up.
I can't think of anything more devastating to the public interest.
We're going to talk more about that Supreme Court decision on campaign finance rules and how foreign corporations might be able to influence American elections now. More in a few minutes. We're also heading to the State of the Union address tomorrow night. Thinking about it, what do you think President Obama might say?
This is Gary from Route 80. Why don't we borrow more money?
Six-word State of the Union address. You can do it, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or post it at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we talk with a former commissioner of the Federal Election Commission about whether the Supreme Court has actually invited unbridled corporate influence in state, local, and federal elections in the United States. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at about 30 minutes after the hour. As James Carville famously told then-candidate Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. And so one day before his first State of the Union address, President Obama is taking that to heart.
We're going to keep fighting to rebuild our economy so that hard work is once again rewarded, wages and incomes are once again rising, and the middle class is once again growing.
There's a package of middle-class family programs to help the middle class, and today we're learning the president is going to ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs. Earlier in the program, we spoke to Jason Johnson, a political science professor in Northeast Ohio, who told us people in his state like what they're hearing about the spending freeze, but it's of little consolation to those without jobs.
The independents who are at home because they haven't found work, they don't care about a freeze in funding. They just want to find out when the jobs are going to be available, if they're going to lose their unemployment benefits. They want to find out if spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week looking for a job is actually going to result in something effective.
So, State of the Union, six words or less.
This is Johnny from Michigan. My state of the nation is quit fighting and get the job done.
Maybe we'll hear that tomorrow night. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org. Back to the news.
This morning, a parliamentary commission in France recommended that Muslim women should not be allowed to wear face-covering veils in hospitals, schools, or while taking public transportation. Anyone who does would be refused residence cards and citizenship. There are an estimated 5 million Muslims in France. And new numbers out last hour show home prices rose nationally for the sixth straight month in November, with 14 of the 20 metro areas tracked showing improvements. Markets are open now. The Dow is down about 40 points. The S&P down 4 points. The NASDAQ is down about 9. Those are some of the news stories you're watching this morning.
So after the Supreme Court ruled last week that corporations have the same rights as individuals under the First Amendment, it seemed a little bit like the balance of powers was little grumpy. Listen to the president talking about the judiciary.
I can't think of anything more devastating to the public interest. The last thing we need to do is hand more influence to the lobbyists in Washington or more power to the special interests to tip the outcome of elections.
the president talking about the Supreme Court ruling on elections that will affect everyone in Congress. Yes, it's a landmark ruling with lots of implications. Joining us now is Scott Thomas, former FEC, Federal Election Commission chairman, who served on the commission from 1986 to 2006. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, John.
So this is a fascinating case, and we could talk about it for a couple of hours here, but let's focus in on the issue of corporations and their giving. Does this decision, and again, it's your opinion, but still, does this decision require the FEC to look more closely at corporations and who's giving to elections, or maybe allows them to not pay so much attention anymore?
Well, I'm guessing that in some respects it will require more work by the FEC, because although the decision in theory has left intact the contribution prohibition that's been in federal law, the question will move to, okay, so what is a contribution and how is a contribution really different from an independent expenditure, which the court freed corporations to make? And the toughest area will really relate to this concept of what is a coordinated communication. And for years, a coordinated communication is treated as a contribution. So that's where the real battle will lie, and lots of folks will be filing complaints saying, well, actually, there was some coordination. The corporate officials were coordinating with a candidate who was the subject of the ad. So
right, so too much.
That's where the battle will be.
Let me just back up for a second. Too much contact with the actual candidate, and it becomes a coordinated direct contribution. But if there's no contact with the candidate, in a sense, there's really no limit to what the corporation can do to fund anything but the direct campaign expenditures of the individual candidate, right?
That's right. What's really been freed up is the so-called independent or uncoordinated ads.
All right. Now, I can certainly look in the mirror and tell the difference between John Hockenberry, American Citizen, and General Motors, U.S. Corporation, or Xerox, U.S. Corporation. I can vote. The corporations can't vote. I have an address here in Brooklyn, New York, in the United States. Corporations can have addresses all over the world. Can foreign corporations get involved in this?
Well, in theory, the foreign national prohibition was not before the court, and in theory, the court has not addressed that. And actually, there is a small passage in the opinion where they sort of point out that they're not interpreting that particular restriction. But you're right, there is just a huge potential for confusion, if you will, because there are so many foreign-owned or foreign-controlled corporations, and the measure of whether or not the foreign national prohibition is still good law is going to be very, very difficult.
But in theory, if I'm the CEO of I Hate America Forever, a company in Saudi Arabia, okay, that's on some side street, and I set up a Gosh We Love America subsidiary in Detroit, Michigan, all right, say, I can contribute to anyone, right?
Well, again, the contribution restriction is going to be in place, but for any corporation. But for independent expenditures, yes. I mean, there's going to be this potential for domestic subsidiaries of foreign-owned or controlled companies to use this new allowance that the Supreme Court has carved out. And the question will be, I suppose, for the FEC, what does it mean when the statute says, well, you can only let a domestic subsidiary get involved that way if it's principally operating in the United States.
Principally operating,
yeah. That's where the battle line will be. It'll be a mess.
And the FEC is going to have to be looking at all that sort of paperwork. Here's a question from one of our listeners.
This is Al in Oklahoma City. If corporations have a right to contribute all the money they want to campaigns, particularly in the form of ads, then they should be held to citizenship regulations just like the rest of us, and they should have to declare a nation of citizenship and pay taxes to that nation.
Now, does something like this force corporations to act more like citizens in the sense that they have to declare, a vote? They do pay taxes already, but how does this change corporations at all?
Well, corporations, when they make a political expenditure, are supposed to track that and make sure that they don't declare that as a business expense deduction when they're calculating their income taxes. So in theory, when you make a political expenditure, you're going to have to pay taxes on the revenue that was used to do that. So that's going to be in place. And for nonprofits also, there are tax provisions that in theory cause them to, in essence, have to pay taxes when they incur those kinds of expenses. But it's very complicated to track, obviously.
Well, before we go, can you envision a campaign, a time when rhetoric like the aluminum industry supports this candidate and that will be part of the language of our politics?
Well, I suppose it depends on how lax the Federal Election Commission is. If the FEC is very, very weak in terms of trying to establish rules about how to define whether a domestic corporation really should be allowed to operate on its own as if it were not a foreign-controlled company, then we've got a problem. If the FEC is tough, in theory, it won't be quite as bad, but it's still going to be very complicated.
Scott Thomas, former Federal Election Commission chairman, talking about last week's decision by the Supreme Court on campaign financing. Coming up, how's the president doing? We talk about the president's time in office so far with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. That's later this hour. And what about you? What do you think the State of the Union and the state of Obama's job performance so far are?
This is Glenn Maxwell in Detroit, and my take on the State of the Union is Obama's change. Democrats didn't get it.
A progressive voice on the State of the Union. Tell us your six-word take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. The pregnancy rate among teenage girls in the United States has jumped for the first time in more than a decade. That's according to a report released today by the nation's leading reproductive health think tank, the Guttmacher Institute. The pregnancy rate among 15 to 19-year-olds increased 3% between 2005 and 2006. Bill Albert joins us now. He's the chief program officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Can you put this in perspective for this? How big a jump is 3%?
Well, given that it's the first increase in the teen pregnancy rate since 1990, I think it's quite startling. And, of course, this comes on the heel of what we already knew, which is 2 years of increases in the teen birth rate. Just to put it in perspective, the pregnancy rate usually comes out later than the teen birth rate, and we've now seen increases in both. So I really think, to me, the headline from this really sobering data is that one of the nation's real shining success stories of the past two decades may be in danger of unraveling.
And that would be the cutting in these numbers. Do we have any idea what's causing it?
Well, I think there are any number of reasons. We had a great formula that was working for us in this country. Again, we saw declines in teen pregnancy in all 50 states and among all racial ethnic groups, and in every year until this most recent data since 1990. And the magic combination was less sex and more contraception. More teens were delaying sexual activity, which is positive, and more sexually active teens who were using contraception more consistently and carefully. That seems to be reversing now, unfortunately.
Were you surprised by these numbers? Or did you expect it?
No, we sort of expected it because, again, we had seen an increase in the teen birth rate. And as a general matter, the pregnancy rate follows the birth rate. So we weren't shocked. But I have to say that it is, even so, it's quite alarming. And we hope, to the extent that there's a silver lining here, that this does serve as sort of a wake-up call to policymakers and practitioners and parents that, you know, what goes down can go back up again, and this does deserve some real attention.
Let's take it one step further in terms of causal relationships. You say that there, you know, we're really good at reducing the amount of sex, and we're really good at upping the use of contraception. What's causing those things to change?
Well, that's really the $100,000 question here. We can only speculate, and here are some things that we hear from folks who work with teenagers on the front lines. One thing they tend to cite is that there is less concern among this generation of young people than in previous generations about STDs in general and HIV in particular. And, of course, that might have an effect on what teens are doing sexually. It's also the case that a lot of the pregnancies occur among 18 and 19-year-olds, and we just haven't done a very good job, in my view, in this country in trying to reach that age group, the older teens. I think it's also true that many young people simply are not or have not gotten enough information about contraception over the past 5-10 years.
Okay, and perhaps affected by the downturn in the economy?
Well, you know, traditionally, if you look at fertility rates as a general matter, they don't track so closely to economic rates, oddly enough. And particularly among teens, I think it's probably not a close relationship.
Great. Thanks. Bill Albert is the Chief Program Officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. He's talking about a new report out today that shows that the pregnancy rate among 15 to 19-year-olds increased by 3% between 2005 and 2006. That's the first increase in more than a decade.
Coming up, I'm John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We talk with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about the State of the Union. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The president lays out his agenda tomorrow night in his first State of the Union address, expecting to outline plans including tighter rules for Wall Street, job creation, lifting the ban on gays in the military. We'll get more on that in just a few minutes. We want your take as well. What is the state of our union, and can you say it all in just six words?
Hi, this is Ben from Clifton, New Jersey. My six-word State of the Union is, on second thought, maybe we can't.
This is Carol from Salt Lake City. My six words would be, how did we get here? Complacency.
I'm Jeff from Lansing, Michigan. My six words are, save our ship, bring jobs home.
Tell us your take at 877-8MYTAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. In Haiti, President René Préval made an urgent appeal yesterday for 200,000 more tents to provide shelter for those left homeless by the earthquake. In solidarity with the victims, he's going to move into a tent on the lawn of the collapsed National Palace in Port-au-Prince.
This morning in Afghanistan, NATO says a blast hit near a U.S. military base in the capital. At least six civilians were wounded. NATO says there have been no reported casualties. Back at home, the Transportation Department has announced an immediate ban on text messaging by truck and bus drivers on the road. And finally, one down, more than 309 million to go. The U.S. Census began the 2010 count of the country's residents in an Arctic village yesterday. The first person tallied was Clifton Jackson, the oldest resident in an Alaskan Inuit community. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
The state of the union.
The state of our union.
State of the union.
My fellow Americans, the state of our union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
Part of our coverage of the State of the Union week, the president addressing the nation on Wednesday night. Doris Kearns Goodwin, presidential historian and author of the book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, along with many other books, joins us from her home. Good morning, Doris.
Good morning, John. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to talk to you again. First of all, how does this shape up historically as a moment? It seems to me just a few weeks ago, Barack Obama had enormous momentum. He was working with the Congress. He bet on the 60-vote majority. It led him down there in Massachusetts. Can you recall a reversal, and it seems to be a reversal, like this in the past?
Well, not in such a period of time, you know, just like weeks before the State of the Union. Although when you think about some of the other dramatic moments of difficulty for presidents, this one is much less difficult than Clinton having to go to the State of the Union, you know, almost days after he announced, I did not have sex with that woman,
yeah,
or having to stand up there when the impeachment trial was already underway. So, I mean, I think he still got a chance to shift the tone. And in some ways, you know, Churchill once said after he lost the election in 1945 that his wife had said to him, don't worry, it's a blessing in disguise. And he said, well, if so, the disguise is pretty well disguised.
That's great.
Maybe this Massachusetts thing will have mobilized him to really focus on whose side he's on and let the country get much simpler understanding of what he stands for.
In a sense, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the president bet on him being able to work with Congress, a bet that Lyndon Johnson made when he passed the civil rights legislation. But is the Congress of Barack Obama the same as the Congress of Lyndon Johnson, either structurally, certainly the personnel have changed?
That's a really good question, John, because I think it's true that he came in with two promises. One, that he was going to change the tone of the way the Congress and Washington worked. In other words, be a more bipartisan leader. And two, he had some real substantive goals that he wanted to achieve in health care, financial reform, and job creation. And I think what the experience of the year has shown was that it wasn't able to produce the bipartisan creation. And I'm not sure that that was his fault. He certainly did go after it in those first couple of months as hard as he could have. Then the time comes, you decide, if I can't get it, then I still have to go forward in a different way. And the way Lyndon Johnson finally got the Civil Rights Act through was he let a filibuster go on for 57 or 67 days before they were finally able to get cloture. You know, and it may be that that's the kind of toughness that you have to bring to bear.
Wow.
Give up on the idea that you're going to get these guys to go along, but say this is important for the country. Let everybody see those guys talking and reading phone books and not going to the bathroom
right.
in order to prevent financial reform, for example. I don't think you should do it on health care. There's not enough agreement on it. But if there's real agreement on financial reform, you present that in the State of the Union, and then you say, okay, we're going to fight for it. You filibuster, let the country see that you're not really for changing Wall Street.
And that was even in the pre-C-SPAN era, and we should remind people that Lyndon Johnson had a generation of political favors grown up from his time in the Congress as a congressman and a senator. Barack Obama wasn't even through his first term there in the Senate. But let's talk tone for a second. Doris, listen to these three statements from Barack Obama, and let's talk for a moment. First, here's a kind of a scary remark from the president.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
And here's Barack Obama being very natural with Diane Sawyer on ABC News.
When your poll numbers drop, you're an idiot. When your poll numbers are high, you're a genius. If my poll numbers are low, then I'm cool and cerebral and cold and detached.
He also described himself as getting a bit gray in his first year. And finally, here's something that's self-deprecating, self-critical.
We've been so focused on just getting things done that I think that we stopped giving voice to the frustrations that people have about the process here in Washington.
Has Barack Obama found a tone, or does he feel a little all over the map? And I picked those clips deliberately. Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Yeah, I think this address, more than many others, tone will matter. And I think there has to be some sense that the people feel he's on their side against the special interests. I mean, the problem in going for so long for health care and the way it finally got done, to the extent that the bills were produced by each house, was that it did seem like a triumph of a lot of little special interests, even though the ultimate result is probably a good thing. So I think the key for him now, every president has to make the general people feel, I'm on your side. It doesn't mean he has to scream and yell about Wall Street, although he has to show strength on it, but it means that he has to make people remember the person who ran that won that election in 2008, where people felt, he'll be fighting for me. I think there has to be a fighting tone. I mean, usually State of the Unions are judged not so much by the performance, even though that's what we'll do the day after, or the popularity of the words, but by whether the president is able to mobilize Congress, the interest groups, and the people to fight for his goals.
Well, that takes us right into history. And resolve a mystery for me. You know, we are always told that in the first off-year election, the president loses seats in Congress. But Franklin Roosevelt, famously, in his off-year election, his first one, gained seats. And his whole approach in talking to the American people was to actually prosecute the financial leaders of the previous administration, to go after the banks, to take a hyper-populist view. Is that even open to Barack Obama?
I don't know. I mean, it took a while even for Franklin Roosevelt to be willing to take that view, because at first he too tried, despite the 100 days, which we remember, where both sides were willing to do something because the Depression was so deep. He tried in the first couple of years to have business go along with him. Some of his early programs had business support, but then they didn't follow through. Finally, they started calling him a traitor to his class, and then finally he gets up and he says, I welcome their hatred.
Right.
And it's hard to imagine Obama saying that. You have to have that willingness inside, but I think he could say, if he talks about financial reform and the need to not allow the banks to do, not just punish them, and that doesn't make sense, but not allow them to do what they did to get us into this again, he's got to show that kind of willingness to say, okay, they're against me, that's fine, I'm on your side.
I'm a big fan of your books. They are big, your books. Lots of words in them.
Big sometimes.
You want to take a shot at our six words or less State of the Union?
Oh, God, no.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Three words, Doris.
Three words.
Three words.
That's good.
Oh, God, no. Doris Kearns Goodwin, presidential historian, author of Team of Rivals, a long book, Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. And that's good. That's good. Her books are long and
they're
fantastic. Tomorrow, as part of our State of the Union series, we're going to talk with Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota.
Let's just turn this over to our listeners now. How do you think President Obama is doing so far? 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website at thetakeaway.org. That's also where you can go to give us your State of the Union. And can you describe it in six words or less?
Hi, this is Gretchen in Boston with my State of the Union. Extraordinary privilege and poverty must work harder.
Hi, this is Peter Leck from Providence, and my six-word takeaway is, yes, we still can.
My name is Dan Gregory, and I'm calling from Lubbock, Texas. My six words are, most people reject your socialist policies.
And on our website, Paul writes, Demo Tragics and Republic Can'ts. Wah, wah, wah. Rick writes, ooh, took over Titanic, turned it around. Give
not
us
bad.
Your take, 8778-MY-TAKE, or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, we have continuing coverage of Haiti with a dispatch from Takeaway intern Eleanor Miller. She went to Haiti to volunteer at a hospital, and you can read her story at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.